What if the secret to a happy, successful life wasn't wealth, power, or even achievement, but something far more human and accessible? In this episode, we'll dive into the groundbreaking Harvard study of adult development, revealing how the quality of your relationships directly influences your personal and professional potential. This is The Partnership Playbook, a podcast helping sales and marketing leaders secure high-value partnerships that finally unlock business growth and reclaim time. I'm your coach, Phil Hay Sinclair. Welcome to the show. Hey everyone, well today we get a chance to talk with Professor Mark Schultz, who has an extraordinary story to discuss. It is one of science and it is one of psychology and one of happiness. And so, Mark, thank you so much for spending time with me today.
A pleasure to be with you, Phil. Looking forward to our conversation.
Likewise. Now, as a business show, often we spend a lot of time talking about the role of partnership to grow. And when you peel back a lot of the layers to that, lives the idea of relationship and the idea of trust and happiness, ultimately. But it's important to try and get a really good understanding of where all of that comes from. And the study that we're going to spend a bit of time talking about today has spanned more than 80 years. It is very rare for scientific studies to persevere that long, and there have been a few. But before we get to that and what happiness means and how we're actually doing on the happiness scale, how did you find your way to psychology and data science and the things that led you to be part of this landmark study?
Yeah, so it wasn't a sort of clear linear path for me, as it isn't for most folks. I was, even as a kid, really interested in observing people. I was a little shy, so I liked to hang back and kind of watch people. And that was something I carried into my studies when I went to university. Really interested in trying to understand what led to people doing things the way they did or experiencing life in the way that they did. So I was interested in science, but in college, I found the social sciences and just sort of loved it. So I read in sociology and anthropology and political science and got excited about trying to understand from a kind of big perspective how humans were shaped. And as I started to think about careers, I wrestled with this fascination with, you know, what these fields taught us about human beings and how we, you know, went about life, and an interest in really helping people directly or spending time with people directly in the work that I did. And that's what eventually led me to psychology. It was after I did my completed my university. I decided after some work experience to go back and to study clinical psychology. And I did my PhD work in clinical psych that allowed me to develop tools to really understand people and tools that could help people flourish in their lives as well as research tools that allowed me to more systematically observe people and figure out what we could learn from their experience and use that learning to help other folks. So That's the short story about how I ended up in psychology, and best decision I ever made, really pleased that I pursued that path.
I often think about how much of a role today, and even in the last decade, psychology plays in just about every quarter. I mean, the world's gone through COVID. Arguably, we're still recovering from the trauma of what that means, and people probably haven't processed that well enough. But I often see that maybe more than 70% of my work as a chief executive and now as a coach is so grounded and needs to be in psychology. And I feel like I'm having to wing it most of the time, because had I spent some time learning what psychology is genuinely all about, I think it would have been such a stronger base to be able to manage and lead. And
right. I think I love those comments, because I think psychology is at a particular time. It's matured as a discipline and as a social science. And I think it's really part of what motivated us to write the book, The Good Life, was a sense that there were findings out there that were languishing in some ways in academic journals and in scholarly discussions that weren't being shared in a way that was accessible to others. So I think I kind of lucked into it, but it's a good time to be a psychologist for the reasons that you're talking about. I think as a society, and certainly in business culture, we've grown much more open to ideas that are coming from the science of psychology. So it's been a good run for me. It's been 30, 40 years, and it's been terrific. What a great field to be in.
Yeah. I mean, now we've also found our way into the chat GPT area or arena, and the way, not necessarily that tool, but certainly the way that AI is helping thread together so many different types of research disciplines, to me is fascinating. As a biologist, when I think about all of the different ways that research has happened, you know, since the beginning of this research field, where it is one person or a group studying one very small molecule that is really trying to understand, but we're still grappling with this idea that there's a system at play and where does that fit and how do we make that work? Yeah. Can we just talk a little bit about the tools aspect that you talked about before? Data science is not a small part of the world that you're part of, and it's part of sort of bringing all of that together. That used to be a spreadsheeting kind of approach to trying to get numbers to make sense. It's a far more mature now, just like psychology is. Can you tell us a little bit about the tool set that you've helped to work on and bring up in that discipline?
Yeah, sure.
Because a lot of people think about software engineering when they think about data science, but I think it's a lot more than that, particularly in your context.
For sure, it is. So it's unusual in some ways to see a psychologist as a director of a data science program, but this really comes for me from a kind of lifelong effort to figure out ways to not just study complex phenomena like emotions and relationships, but to figure out ways to systematically collect information that we can analyze and answer questions about. So I've been in fields that people have warned folks away from, that they're too hard to study. Emotions are ephemeral and hard to, you know, really capture in any systematic way. Even the notion of happiness, you know, people doubt that it could be studied as a science because it's subjective, is what people say. So to me, those are challenges. We have to be creative and figure out methods that allow us to systematically study these kind of phenomena. And then once we collect these data, particularly when we collect it in the context of an 87-year-old study where we have these data across time, we have to use the full, you know, set of tools that modern technology has created. And that means systematically taking that data, analyzing in a way that is similar to some of the ways that we analyze big data now. So when we're talking about the big data that's collected every day, you know, just so much information we collect on people and experiences around the world. It's similar in a way with a project that studied people for 87 years. We have lots and lots of data points, and the challenge is how you combine them and integrate them in ways that provide new insights, and then how you communicate them as well. So an important part of my job as an educator in data science is teaching students how to communicate very complicated information in ways that are friendly to the person who you're communicating to. So it's a lot like user experience in some ways, but it's communicating complicated information in ways that are digestible and engaging to the listener or the viewer. And I, you know, find that really interesting to help people learn how to do that. So that's what we're thinking about in terms of data science.
Yeah, look, I am completely with you. And when I think about it, still blows my mind that there is a study that has been going for that long. There have, like I said before, very few that have persevered that long. I still go back to the people that were the founders of the studies and thinking about what they were hoping, which I think every scientist kind of hopes for, right? Like I'm starting this piece of investigation. I'm hoping someone will pick it up and continue funding it, continue building it out to make it work. Just quickly, what do you think they would be saying now for those that are still with us or those who aren't still with us, to sort of think about what it would be like to go 87 years, all this information? Like it's something else, right?
It's incredible. I think, you know, they started with more modest aspirations. So the study started in late 1930s. It was an interesting time. It was the end of the Depression in the United States. It was the eve of World War II. It wasn't a time that people were thinking about flourishing, but somehow in Boston, and it was two separate studies initially that they were both interested in human flourishing. So one study focused on inner city folks that had grown up in the poorest circumstances. These were teens that were living in Boston's poorest neighborhoods. And the other part of the study focused on students who were at Harvard University. In both studies, they were interested in flourishing, and they thought maybe if they were lucky, they'd have funding for 5 years, is what they really hoped for in the beginning. And, you know, through a lot of luck and really good leadership has been a key aspect of the study. And we're the fourth generation of leadership in the study. So it's had really consistent leadership across time. The study's continued, and it's remarkable. I feel very fortunate. I've been with the study for 20 years or so. So there's 67 years of history that I've been lucky to be able to work with. And it's remarkable. And a lot of it really is due to very creative and thoughtful leadership and a little bit of luck, as it always happens as well. So,
well, look, let's dive right into this study, because I think there is so much to talk about here. The Harvard study of adult development, it spans as long as we've talked about. What is the study hoping to achieve, and what do you think, from your vantage point, it's helping tell us about humanity?
Yeah. So this was a study that I suggested started as two separate studies and then merged along the way. It was 724 original participants. And the goal was really to understand, in different contexts, very difficult, challenging contexts and relatively privileged contexts, what led to flourishing. So in some ways, it was the beginning of positive psychology. Mm-hmm. They had an idea that if we could study normally developing people in that context, we'd learn why some people seem to do well and others might be challenged in those circumstances. And those main goals have continued through this modern period, 87 years later. The techniques have changed. So we're using brain scans and collecting blood to analyze what's going on inside the body. And we're using other new technologies. But the questions are similar and the approach is actually similar. So the other thing that distinguishes this study is it wasn't just interested in following people across time. They were interested in really understanding what was going on inside people's heads. So they spent a lot of time interviewing 724 participants and their families. Mm-hmm. They visited the homes to look at what the home environment was like when they were growing up. And they followed people very closely throughout their lifespan. So regular interviews, visits to the families, observations of them interacting with important people in their life, collection of medical data. So this is a study that has followed people very intensely, mm-hmm. with the idea that if we use the right methods, we can understand what people's hopes and worries are for the future, what kinds of challenges they've had. So for 87 years, we've been doing that. And we're now studying the second generation, the 1,300 children of the original participants have agreed to participate. Wow. Along the way, the original study was all male, which was a challenge in terms of generalizability. But along the way, the wives of original participants became members of the study. So we've studied well over 3,000 people from these families, and just a remarkable set of data about how lives unfold across time, and also in some ways about our history, about how things have changed across time as well, because certainly things have changed across the 9 decades that the study's been going.
Oh, remarkable change. You know, when we think about, I'm trying to think about what it would look like for somebody who is, I guess, one of those starting men. And if you were to characterize that, putting the generalizability aside,
yep.
you know, you look at what their experience was maybe over a 2-decade time frame. Is it easy or relatively straightforward to understand, if we take then another 20 years, maybe the most recent 20 years, what the differences are in those two groups?
No, it's not so easy. And again, I like research that has challenges. So you can think about the challenges in lots of ways, but the way we talk about, for example, happiness or our emotions has changed quite notably in 87 years. So this generation of men grew up being told to not talk about their inner experience, to be independent. It was a kind of Western individualized ideal that they'd grown up with. The men who were part of the Harvard sample went to the war, went to World War II. 91% of them served in the military. So they had experiences that shaped their views of the world that I think are very different than young people have today. Mm-hmm. So when we're studying the second generation, the language that we have to use, the kinds of questions that we ask, have to be adapted to fit into the culture of the current culture as opposed to the culture of 87 years ago. And that creates some challenges in consistency, right? So the same question, are you happy, doesn't really mean the same thing in 2025 that it might have meant in 1938. So we have to be thoughtful about that. The advantage we have is we keep asking them these questions. So we don't have to just depend on one point in time. We can look at the arc of what they say, what's making them happy or what they worry about. And that gives us insights that few other studies have, because we can really go in depth and understand how the subtle changes across time, what they may mean for that individual, and then, of course, for the group as a whole. So this research is not without its challenges, even though it's extraordinary, sure. the amount of data that we have on folks. And one of the challenges is thinking about what the equivalent constructs are across time. That's a real challenge. But it also teaches us a lot about history and also about what's common to humanity as we change and perhaps what's different. Yeah, so that's part of what's been interesting about working with these data.
Oh, it's extraordinary. I mean, my mind is stretching pretty hard at the moment to sort of think about, you know, something, if we were to ask the question, you know, are you living a fulfilling life
yep.
in 1949? You know, the war has just ended.
Yep.
There is a lot of post-war construction and you know, the way that the US culture evolved, particularly during that time, was extraordinary. Then we look today where there is, you know, even if we asked, you know, last week, are you having a fulfilled life? I can see why those two times are so vastly different. Yep. But you would hope that down, I guess, beneath all of that is a sense that there is a combination of fortune and gratitude and, you know, for all the things that I guess we take for granted. You know, we have, for the most part, access to reasonably good healthcare. We have access to reasonable peace. We have access to reasonable employment. And, of course, there are always ups and downs to that.
Yep.
Post-war, I imagine that was probably not dissimilar, but you know, we weren't all living in giant houses and we weren't all making a lot of money. There was a very different way of, I guess, normalizing for what a fulfilled life would look like, I imagine.
I think that's right. And I also want to add, besides all the good things that we associate with a good life, there were also the challenges that we all experienced. So again, 91% of this Harvard sample served in the military, many of them in combat positions, came back from the war with significant trauma and the experience of processing that event. Now, young folks born today in Western countries may be less likely to have that kind of exposure to war, but there are other challenges that we have that sure. this generation is facing. So one of the lessons from studying people across these nine decades is that the challenges that we think are rare are actually pretty common in people's lives. It's the way that we meet those challenges. That's the critical piece. Some of them might be societal challenges like the recent pandemic, and some of them might be challenges that are just unique to us, a particular health scare or a family challenge that we have. But one key idea, I think, Phil, to interject here is we spent some time before we wrote The Good Life thinking about the study and the hundreds of papers that it's produced and the more than 15 books that had come out before our own book, and thinking whether there was some general lesson that can be taken from this study of 87 years, but also across generations. And the lesson was pretty clear because of the number of findings that suggested the following. It's really simple to summarize. It's relationships that keep us healthier and happier throughout the lifespan. This was true in 1938. This is true in 2025. It was true when the participants went to war and they were in foxholes, depending on the person next to them for their life and also for their emotional well-being. So the research really points fairly clearly, our own research and also the thousands of other studies that we reviewed for our book, points to the importance of connection or partnership, as you might talk about.
Sure. And so I would love to piggyback off the back of that into the idea of people being connected. And the, you know, I often hear the concept of a loneliness epidemic that we seem to find ourselves in for a whole range of different points of view, whether it be devices, technology, whatever else that we could talk about. I wonder when you think about, you know, that causality being so strong, when you are trying to help somebody understand, maybe in a personal or even in a business context, how to build a muscle around, or at least an appetite to build those close relationships, which of course take time and can be truncated if you're put in a situation where things are a little bit more dire. Being ex-military, I understand what you mean around, you know, when you serve with people and you go through hardship together, relationships can be formed extremely quickly with a very yep. high degree of intensity.
Yep.
And they persevere for a very long time afterwards. And many will be able to talk to that. I wonder when somebody is unlikely to go through that, maybe like you said before, today's generation may not have to face into that, although many have. How do you think about coaching them into thinking about the power of relationship when maybe in their life to date they haven't had that many close relationships or experience about how to go about doing that?
Yeah, I think it's such an important question. I teach, you know, I'm a professor, I've been teaching in a university for over 30 years. And students today are really thinking a lot about their connection to others. Many of them feel quite alone, as you suggest, and which means that they don't feel like other people have their back or really know who they are. Mm-hmm. So they struggle with this. And I think it's partly a consequence of the pandemic and some of the other issues like technology that you've talked about. So really important to talk about it. You had a metaphor there about flexing our social muscles, and that's a metaphor that I think is quite appealing. We talk about it as social fitness, that mm-hmm. the first important idea is, if we know, and we do know this, that connections are critical for our physical well-being and our emotional well-being, we need to figure out a way to exercise those social muscles. They're really critical. And we need to lean in just as we do for physical fitness, just as we get ourselves to walk when we're tired or to go to the gym when we have other things to do. We need to think about ways to improve our connections to others. And that means our connections to people we care about. It might be coworkers or people that are important to us in work or in personal relationships, family, friends, neighbors. It's all the connections that we have in our life. Rather than let them go on autopilot, we need to be much more forward-thinking and proactive in thinking about what can I do now to improve those connections, both the close ones and the distant ones. So the first step is really taking a much more proactive, intentional approach, stepping back and thinking a little bit, just like you would before you go to the gym. What are the kinds of things in relationships or the connection world that I need to work on? So if it's in the workplace, you know, how am I doing in terms of mentoring junior people that I supervise? Am I really interested in their whole person, or am I just worried about getting this project done? Could I do better on that front? Am I showing interest and curiosity about the people that I work with, genuine interest? Am I able to put away the deadlines that are hovering around in my head and the phone that's interrupting me all the time and look at a person when I'm talking to them and be really interested in what they have to say? So, you know, attention to social connections and then building those muscles by being present, being curious, interested in the other person. I think in reality, it's sort of simple. You know, all of us want to be seen and heard and understood. It's a very simple thing, but it's not easy in today's world to be able to experience that when people are so distracted. So if we can be present, curious, and interested in them, show people some respect and a recognition maybe that differences that we have can be exciting and interesting as opposed to threatening, I think those are pretty important steps to improving connections in the world at large.
I remember having a very a strange experience with one of our country's leading journalists. His name is Ray Martin. And we had an opportunity to spend a lot of time together on a project. And I will never forget how when we were talking one-on-one, he had such a singular focus on everything that I was saying, a deep curiosity. It was like the whole world could have fallen apart around us and he wouldn't have flinched. And it was because, and it could be his training as a journalist. We didn't want to miss something, but it felt like a much deeper muscle that he'd created to want to not miss, almost a fear of missing out on a genuine perspective.
And what does that feel like for you as the recipient of that stare, right? That's the interesting thing.
Extraordinary.
It's extraordinary, right?
I mean, yeah. It was, and I'll never forget it. And it was, for every opportunity I can do that, the exercise was to not peer at somebody with sort of an open kind of stare, but more to sort of just be so curiously into what's going on. And it's really interesting how much more rich those relationships become. Because you're right, the other person feels it in a way that's like, I don't get this kind of attention very much.
We did some research years ago. This is Bob Waldinger and I, and we studied married couples and we followed them very closely. We brought them into the lab and we had them talk about a difficult topic. And we asked them to report. They watched their videotape of the interaction. We asked them to report on what their emotions were at specific times during that videotape. And then we asked them, it's a kind of empathy task. We asked them what they imagined their partner was thinking. And it turned out that it was less important whether they got it right or not, what their partner was thinking, but it was critical that their partner thought they were trying to understand them. That was the key to understanding their happiness in that marriage. So I think you're right, Phil. One of the secrets is we can listen intently and we may not get it all. We may misunderstand something, but people experience that listening as a gift. They feel kind of heard and seen in a way that, frankly, is quite unusual in today's modern world where we're rushing around and we don't give people our attention.
Look, there is such a very clear business parallel to this. Some of the best business developers I've ever come in contact with, and I just want to sort of create a division here between the people who are the snake oil salesmen and the people trying to push things onto you versus the people who are genuinely there because they deeply believe that they've got potentially a solution to a problem that you've got. And they're I guess they're the ones that you all often reflect on and say, I never felt like I was ever being sold to.
Yep.
These are the people, and I've met people in fields from investment banking to biotech, right through to education and then into defense and aerospace, where they have that very rich capacity to want to understand and want to want to learn, that it oozes out of them. And not surprisingly, they become known as the node of influence because more people want to talk to them, so they have a greater understanding of what's going on.
Because those are the people who know stuff. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's not rocket science in my mind, but I think there's a lot of people that miss that one insight around just trying to understand. And you can't do that when you're multi-distracted. It's got to be, you got to be into the other person, right?
I think that's absolutely right. I love the example. And one thing I want to say is it's not just the recipient of that knowledge that benefits, it's the person who listens intently also benefits. So if we really think people grow and learn and flourish because of relationships, the people who are most connected, and part of that is that ability to lean in and to listen and to be present with other people, that has a value for us. So that connective work benefits us as well. It's not just the person that we're listening to. We feel connected. We feel human. It reminds us that the world is larger than just what's going on inside our head, which is really important, I think, for our well-being.
I'm loving this conversation, Mark. This is at the absolute core of most of what I spend my time talking and coaching about. It's just so fascinating. Thank you. Let's imagine for a second that we take all this knowledge and we are trying to work out how to repair or reset a relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, for the most part, people can grow apart. There can be things that go on. How should we think about the way of repairing and reconnecting? Is it as simple as wanting to learn more about that person, to present that kind of emotion for them to feel and then to start building a bridge again? Or is there something else here that we need to be thinking about?
I think it's a good start to have interest in the other person and to communicate the idea that you're not just interested in them, but you're interested in them doing well, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a positive kind of warmth. It's not unlike what you hope you might have gotten when you were a child from a parent. That we're trying to communicate to them, we're both curious and interested, and we have their best interest at heart as well. Mm-hmm. But I think one critical thing to recognize is that, you know, it's the beautiful irony of relationships. So they're key to our flourishing, but they're also messy and complicated and challenging. So there's no relationship that doesn't have challenges. When two people are connected in any way, they grow and change over time. Eventually, there's going to be a difference of opinion, a difference in strategy, a difference in style that's going to become difficult to navigate. So I think it's critical just to recognize that we have a romantic view of relationships, that some of them go easy and simple and you don't have to do very much. And I think that romantic view has some dangers because it suggests to people when they have challenges, there must be something wrong with either the other person or with me. And really, it's about relationships. There are always going to be differences to navigate, differences in how we process emotions or our styles for doing things, whether we plan ahead and are very organized, or whether we have a kind of creative mindset that we don't want to plan in that way. So I think first step is being interested in the other person. The second step is just recognizing that when challenges occur, they're natural, and they're actually opportunities to learn about the other person. So, you know, you do things differently than I do. It's so interesting to me. I'm curious. I can't wait till the last minute to do something when I have a deadline. I get too anxious. I have to do it earlier. Yeah. Mm. Why is it that you wait? And the person might say, I do my best work when I'm under pressure, or I'm not actually waiting until the deadline. There are lots of ideas percolating in my head. I'm doing a lot of work, even if it doesn't get onto paper. I do a lot of writing, so I'm thinking about examples relevant to that, but I think it can be generalized to other kind of work tasks as well. So if we can listen to the other person without judgment, without moving to decide that difference is worse than us or maybe even better than us and we're the bad person, we can often learn from that difference and the relationship can grow. So relationships that go smoothly generally maybe don't have as much growth in them. But when we have challenges in relationships, they really are, it's hard work, but it's an opportunity for growth, both for us and for the relationship. It can take it to that next level. So I think those are some ideas. We have some ideas in our book, The Good Life, about ways to structure engagements or relationships that have gotten difficult that involve slowing things down, taking perspective, thinking about whether there's another way of thinking about this that you hadn't entertained. But generally, it means slowing down and allowing yourself the possibility that there are different ways of understanding your partner and the situation that you've gotten yourselves into.
This is so parallel to what we teach in business partnerships. It is identical to what we teach, and because it is hard. And I think the biggest myth that we tend to bust when people are very frustrated about commercial growth is they look to an alternative and they think, well, partnerships, of course, that makes sense. And the romance associated with that term is very dangerous because anything worth doing is hard, right? Yep. And there are things that we need to sort of make possible and have that space. I think what you're talking about, to ask a question and to slow down, has become a tactic that we've employed almost universally in my last sort of five companies. I was using this most days because I am somebody who used to be very responsive. So if there was an issue, let's dive in and let's solve. I had a sort of a leadership philosophy, which was, if I can solve the greatest problem of the day, then it will unlock the capacity of my team to keep moving forward.
Yep.
Kind of okay in theory, not great at a practical level. And so what I found was the idea of trying to fully take hold of that space between stimulus and response, that was fine to try and do that, but there's something had to be inserted in order for that not to become days of time between stimulus and response. And what I found was asking the question why something became a very effective way to have people want to bring problems to me, but also to allow them to start doing some self-solving through that process as well.
Yeah. So two thoughts, you know, really love this conversation. Two thoughts. One is that I've worked with lots of people in the business world, and this idea about conquering problems is big, right? That you have a problem, you want to solve it quickly. Some problems don't lend themselves to quick solutions, and then you're stuck, right? Because you haven't delivered on your promise that you're going to fix this quickly. And maybe it's a problem that may not be easily solved in the long run. You need to take a different approach or to find a different strategy. So I think first is a recognition that there's other work that leaders can do besides solve problems, that part of your task is to motivate folks and, again, to help nurture their well-being in some way so that they can conquer problems when those opportunities arise. So part of it is dealing with the emotions that the challenge generates, whether it's anxiety or fear or sadness that something didn't work, and not being so afraid of those, that they're okay. So I think that's the other trick when it comes to relationships, is that the emotions that we all experience, which can be very challenging and hard for us at times, they're not going to destroy us if we're just a little bit brave to confront them. And having support to confront them, I think, is important. So whether it's a big change in an organization or a new partner, as you're suggesting, where you have to adapt to those needs, some of the things that are going to be challenging are the emotions that situation engenders. So I think part of the task of a leader is also modeling. It's okay to talk about emotion. It's okay to recognize that that's part of the challenge here. There'll be lots of adapting to new ways of thinking. Some of those might be quite frustrating. We're used to doing things a certain way. There's lots of ways to model and communicate that that's a part of any challenge. We know from our data, again, very clearly how people navigate challenges, key for their adaptation, key for their well-being. And we also know generally, although I want to be careful about no one size fits all when it comes to challenges, there's no one solution. But one thing that distinguishes folks that generally do better are folks that are able to lean into challenges as opposed to say, I don't even want to think about it, or I'm not even going to acknowledge that there's a challenge because I want to go forward without worrying about it. People who can acknowledge those challenges tend to do better at engaging others in collaboration to solve the challenge that's facing them. If I don't have a challenge, I can't acknowledge it. I can't engage anyone to help me fix that challenge. So being able to provide that space, I think, is really critical. That's a lesson from the study as well.
Before we keep going, Mark, where can I be pointing people to so they can learn more about your work and also about the book? We'll link to these in the show notes. So where should we send people?
So probably the best way is the Good Life, which came out in paperback just in the last month. So it should be available in bookstores and certainly online as well. The Good Life was written as a way to communicate these sort of extraordinary findings from this, you know, 87-year-old study in a way that's compelling and engaging. So we tell it through the stories of some of the individuals that we've studied across time. And there are lessons there about, you know, how to live a good life and lessons about what we can and can't learn from science and practical tips, as we're talking about things that you can do. So I think that's probably the best way. You can also find information online about our study at the study website for the Harvard Study of Adult Development as well.
It's amazing. I cannot wait to get this. And because my mum will be listening to this, I know that she'll be getting this book very, very quickly soon after we finish this conversation. Mark, can I just go back to something you mentioned before about social fitness? So obviously organizations are made up of very diverse individuals, and we have now a very almost standard way of having people distributed versus people together. In Australia, on average, I think now where we've landed is, you know, 3 days in the office tends to be the general norm for companies that can operate in that format. Obviously not all of them can. And this idea of social fitness is important. I'm just wondering, how would you help leaders who want their culture to shift a little bit towards this idea of partnership-driven growth? And just to set the scene a little bit on this, most companies that have formed a view on trying to grow through partnership, whether it be through their supply chains or whether it be through, you know, distribution partnerships, they often leave that to a team or a group of people who are central to sales or supply. And it's really their job and no one else's job. And there is a line of inquiry here that says, well, actually, if you want to increase the luck surface area of partnership formation, then empower a lot of people to do it.
Yep.
Don't just let this small group of people be the ones to do it. So when it comes to social fitness and the group of people who maybe feel quite reserved, I don't want to say they're introverted because there's a different power dynamic there, but there will be people who will have different likes for becoming a connector. How could we encourage leaders to think about infusing more of that and to help people come up maybe a curve of social fitness? Obviously, it's going to benefit them, I would imagine, outside of work as well, but it does have, I think, a pretty interesting commercial application.
So a few thoughts, Phil. I mean, the first one is to recognize that we do come in different flavors, right? We have different personalities. So we all need connection, but we may go about it in different ways. And I think that's a fundamental idea for any organization that's interested in inclusiveness, right? So I may want to engage with people in big groups because I'm more outgoing and that's where I get my energy from. And others may do best when they're having smaller conversations, one person at a time, and they may need time to recover. That may also be an important part of who they are. So I think we need to recognize that. And certainly cross-culturally, if you're an international business and you're working in different settings, we need to recognize that people go about relationships in different ways. So that's a kind of fundamental start that I think is critical. I do think that this should be distributed, that if we really believe connections are important to our health, we can't leave it just to certain individuals. We all need to play a part. We all potentially benefit from those connections. So I think leadership is really critical, like starting at the top, modeling this idea of being interested and attentive and curious about other people. So for me, I teach. So my opportunity is, instead of rushing into the classroom at 1 minute before the class starts and fussing with my computer, I come early, and the students that sit down and take out their phones and looking online, I walk around the classroom and I talk to them. I say, you know, what's going on? I haven't had a chance to walk around campus today. What's going on? Interesting shirt. You know, what does that mean? Whatever writing is on the shirt. I have thousands of conversations about shirts, right? Because these are young people. That's where they're advertising their identity. So it's modeling for them. I'm the leader in this situation, that I'm interested in having a conversation, not interested just in having people come into my classroom and sit and be quiet. That's not what I'm interested in. So we can do that in lots of ways. You can have Zoom calls in which people get on early and there's some informal chat. You can start Zoom calls, as our top health official in the United States has suggested, with a kind of checking in, mm-hmm. maybe one or two people. Phil, how was your weekend? You know, anything exciting going on for you? The weather's been so nice. Have you had a chance to go outside? Those kinds of things can be part of Zoom calls, as opposed to only thinking about these as transactional events that have an agenda and we have to do it as efficiently as possible. Mm. Another idea is social infrastructure in the settings that we work in. So if people are coming in 3 days a week, we want to maximize the use of that in-person time for building connections. It's really critical. So what kinds of things can we do? Gyms can be useful. Book clubs during lunch can be useful. Mm-hmm. People go out for a walk routinely. Encouraging those kinds of connections across teams, within teams, I think is really critical. That's true in our societies as well. So I like to say gardens are wonderful things in cities, but a gardening club where you can grow your own vegetables and ask someone for advice, that's how you build connection. So yep. being with people in activities across time is how we build connections and friendships. And I think it's best if companies think about how to build spaces and processes that encourage people to have that kind of side-by-side activity where they can begin to share, as they're comfortable, more intimate aspects of, of themselves. You know, I love rugby, or I hate rugby, or, you know, I'm married. Are you married? You know, that's the opportunity when we work side-by-side with people. Doing work helps. That's okay as an activity, but also doing other things in work can be useful as well. Cafeterias are a lovely idea too. So I think we need to maximize what's happening when people are present in organizations and make sure that they're not just withdrawing to their offices, because they might as well be at home if that's all that they're doing, right?
Yeah, I get that. And I guess to your point as well, people feeling a sense of confidence if they can actually have those conversations or not. You talk in your work a lot about vulnerability
yep.
and you know where that plays a role. I think many leaders are still grappling with the idea of what that actually means. You know, too far is sometimes too far, too little is very obvious.
Yep.
And you know, I think it's another muscle that we're all trying to build. And often being pleasantly surprised when you extend a little bit further and you are a little bit more vulnerable,
yep.
it gives a degree of context that might've been missing previously that helps make sense of who you are as a leader or as a person, as an operator.
I think that's right. And this is a place where we need to have some kind of empathy and recognition, right? That this is harder for some than others. Mm-hmm. Some people are lucky enough to have grown up under circumstances where they were encouraged and they grew that kind of confidence to occasionally be vulnerable. And they have an expectation that when they're vulnerable, people are going to be kind. And other right. people, unfortunately, have grown up in tougher circumstances where their expectation is actually the opposite. If you make yourself vulnerable, you're likely to get hurt. So leaders need to recognize that people come in again in different flavors. That's one of the important dimensions. So we can't demand that people be vulnerable in certain ways, but we can provide opportunities in which people might feel safe to be a little more vulnerable than they are in ways that can deepen connections. I think that's the critical part. And that's where modeling is really helpful too. So, you know, as a leader, really important for us to acknowledge our own foibles, what we're good at, what we're not at, what we found helpful in other people, creating a culture that I think celebrates people who are being generous, right, are giving to others. Being good mentors, that's another way that we help do this as well, because we all need help.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the most powerful things that I've come to understand in vulnerability is affording an invitation mm-hmm. to do that. You know, we can always be very mindful about how we act, what we say, how will it be perceived, all the things that happen when you're trying to build relationships. But I also think the idea of saying point blank, I invite you to tell me about, and being very overt about that invitation, that if for whatever reason you're not vibing with my sort of interpersonal invitation for that, then if you hear it, it's like, oh, he actually said I could do this. And it's like, yeah, let's have that conversation. Let's learn more about that, because I think it's really important.
I love that. You know, one of the things that's interesting, there are all sorts of things that are interesting about growing older, but one thing for me is that I had some health problems last year and I'm teaching and I'm in obvious discomfort. So I shared with students what was going on and I was amazed at how sympathetic they were in their response, how comforted I felt by them saying, "Are you okay? Can I help you?" You know, so without being vulnerable, we don't see those opportunities, right? And this was different for me. I've never missed a class in my life. This was hard, right? It was a hard thing for me, but there were things that I learned in that experience that were quite valuable. People surprise you, you know, when you give them the chance. So.
I completely agree. Mark, I have a rapid fire tradition on this show. We're going to get to that at some point, but before we do, I just want to offer you just such thanks for this conversation. I feel that there is a number of conversations I'd love to have with you on this topic because it is a big one, and there is more ideas coming to my mind about how we can sort of apply this research into other parts of business. You know, we're in a stage now. This has been recorded in February of 2025. There has been a lot of change happening in the world just in the last 5 years. I think we could probably argue there's a lot more coming. You know, the idea of the constructs of the world are being played with in a way which is helping reframe how people are thinking about their own lives, what it means for their families, their nations. I'm just wondering at the moment, what do you think people are missing about the idea of relationship and partnership? And I know it's a big question.
Two things come to mind. I mean, one is I think we all underappreciate how critical they are. So there are examples that we talk about in our book of studies in which people are given options to talk to others or to try and do some work, for example, on the way to work, on the commute to work. And almost everyone says, "Oh, I don't want to talk to strangers on the train. I'd rather do work. It's more productive." And then psychologists do cruel things. They'll randomly assign people and say, "I want you to talk to strangers on the train." The people who are randomly assigned to talk to strangers report not only being happier at the end of their commute — this is on a short commute in Chicago on the train — they reported it was more productive the time, or equally productive the time that they spent talking to someone else rather than trying to do work. So what a number of us have taken from that is that we tend to underestimate the value of connection, even superficial or weak ties like this, where it's a stranger on a train. If we look at the data, it's very clear. Close connection is associated with us living longer, facing less illness, and thriving psychologically. So it's good for us. That's one idea. And then the other idea is very different. It's different than — that's a kind of transactional view. We should pay more attention to relationships, or functional view, because they're good for us. The other concern, which I think is a mistake that people make, they view a lot of things, particularly in the work world, as only about transaction or expedience. So if I can have this call remotely on some sort of virtual platform, I won't have to commute. I won't have to walk out of my office. It's just more efficient. And it might be more efficient in the short run, but we give up things by the lack of conversation that we're able to have in that venue. So I want us all to think about the value that relationships really play. So again, I'm an educator, I'm a professor. I have colleagues who probably are a little on the burned out side, having done this for a long time. They'll moan about the students aren't the same and they don't work as hard as they used to, and our colleagues don't really care about what they're doing anymore. And I can't imagine — I've been doing this for over 30 years — I can't imagine doing my job without feeling the excitement of my colleagues and my students. That's why I do this job. It's the connections that I make with them. So instead of thinking about it as fully about expediency and efficiency, we need to recognize that part of what brings us joy and meaning in life are the connections that we make. And that's especially so for those of us who spend most of our working time in the world of work. We need to figure out a way to make them work for us as well. Not just objects to get something done or to complete a sales call, but as meaningful interactions that have benefits to us.
Can I just build on the back of that? Because I think there is also an idea of, there was once a time when we might have had relationships with people, and students and educators is a great example of that, right? You touch somebody's life when they're an undergraduate, and it's, you know, it's now 15, 20 years down the track. And for whatever reason, there has been this signal that has been sent into their world that said, "Oh, I learned that from, you know, Professor Mark, and I just got to sort of reconnect." And now you've seen tens of thousands of students in your career, and educators have this, for the most part, have this mind-blowing capacity for names and faces. And they go, of course, you know, I remember you. You were like, you know, 91 and whatever the case was. And it brings it back to a point which is really, really quite something. I wonder, you know, the capacity to pick up where you left off is something that you hear of people who are, in inverted commas, old friends. But I'm not sure it's just with old friends, right? I think there is something about we had an intersection at one point. It was positive.
And meaningful. Yeah.
And meaningful. Yeah. Someone got benefit, hopefully both parties. And now picking up again, it feels like, oh, that was fantastic. I think the best humans in the world generally who are able to go, yeah, I remember that. That was great. How have you been?
I maybe I'm the old guy here, Phil, so I want to interject so your listeners don't get too nervous. I'm not so good at remembering the names from 30 years ago, but I remember the experiences. As I start to talk to them, I say, of course I remember you, and it was in this class. Is that right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have to remind me your name, though, right? I mean, fortunately, at events reunions, people wear name tags. That's what I want to say. But I think you're right. And part of that is being interested in people, right? So I wasn't just trying to get through the day 25 years ago when that student was in my class. I recognized that part of my job was connecting with them in a way that they would be more motivated, excited about being there. And also they had contributions to make. So I recognize I go to work every day and I learn from young people. I learn all sorts of, the world is changing, as you suggested, and it's young people that tend to lead the way. Mm-hmm. So if we open ourselves up to listening to them, really, you know, I'm ahead of the curve for most people my age because I get to listen to young people most of the time, talk about their experiences. So that's really fortunate.
Oh, what a conversation, Mark. Let's do this rapid fire so I can let you get on with your day. Thank you for investing the time with me today. It's been something
My pleasure.
And like I said, we will do this again, hopefully. So let's get into these five questions. Question number one, complete this sentence. Partnership is?
I'd say magical and critical. You know, it's magical because things happen when you connect with people. They're just incredible. And there's an energy in your body that's really, you know, incredibly important to us. And it's critical because we can't live without connection to others. So it's just fundamental.
Question two, what content are you loving at the moment? And by the way, this can be anything. You can go from Netflix right through to academic research, whatever you like. What is the content you're loving right now?
I tend to be someone who loves long form journalism. So I read kind of nonfiction in serial form in journals. So something like The Atlantic in particular. Love reading articles about particular challenges in society. That's how I spend my lunch typically and evenings as well. I also like to read historical fiction. So that's another way I like to learn about old times, just like I do when I do the work that I do for my research. But this is another way to get into the life of people from a different era or a different culture as well. So,
one of the most brilliant podcasts that my wife and I have really dived into is called The Rest is History. And I'm sure you might be familiar with it. Mm-hmm. The way that these two professors are able to bring their British sense of humor into history and unpack it is really something else. Yeah. It's just such a joy to listen to.
Yeah.
All right. Question number three, what's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
I would say kind of warnings about trusting others. You know, some people say it just flatly, don't trust others. And you know, I grew up, I had a lovely childhood. I feel really lucky. I had parents that were, you know, concerned and cared for me. It wasn't without its challenges, but it all good from my perspective, or mostly good from my perspective. So there are moments where I feel worried about my vulnerability as well, or I worry about someone taking advantage of me. So that don't trust advice, I think, is dangerous. I think we need to be careful and thoughtful about it. There are good reasons why some people should not trust others. They've learned that and they need to be careful. But we also need to learn to develop a sense of when trust is important. And we need to, I guess, work on our trust as well. It's a muscle that we can build as well. Learn ways to extend trust and also protect ourselves when we need it. It sounds almost like a tension, but I think we get better at that as we get older.
I think you're right. The idea of anything being anything that is binary is correct is often something which I've found not to be true. So I try to follow some advice. Question four, when you see potential for a new partnership or relationship, what's the first thing you do to transform that potential into action?
Yeah, so I tend to want to figure out a way to spend time with that person. So, you know, if it's someone I really want to work on a project with and continue to grow this relationship, I'm going to make regular time that we're going to be together, both for the work of the project and maybe even some more social or less structured time. I want to get to know that person. And that helps me identify, you know, common goals, common interests, and ways in which we can complement each other. So we don't need to be the same. I wrote The Good Life with Bob Waldinger, who I've worked with for 30 years. Bob and I bring different strengths to the table, and together we do things that we can't do alone. So one of the challenges in new partnerships is figuring out what are the common interests and styles you have, and what are the differences, and how can you take advantage of those differences, perhaps to complement what you may not be as good at. So I think that's how I start thinking about it.
It's a great answer. And you know what? 92%, I think we ran the numbers yesterday, 92% of people that ask that question say exactly that. Huh. It's a very common response.
And
correctly so. Correctly so. Right, final question. What's one thing you're deeply grateful for today, Mark?
Oh, I'm grateful for so much. Family. I mean, I guess in this context, what I want to say is, you know, 5 years ago, we started to write a book that we hoped in our kind of wildest hope might reach people and be useful to them. And that book has been an international bestseller. We feel incredibly lucky and grateful for that feedback that we're getting from people, that it's been important in their life, that it's helped them think about things or change the way they go about things in important ways. That's a really nice feeling, not just because we hoped it would be true, but it's nice to feel like other people have found what you've done useful.
Professor Mark Schultz, the book is called The Good Life. It is linked below. I just cannot recommend people enough to go and take a look at that and understand what that is all about. The idea that this research project has yielded such value and continues to is mind-blowing to me. And I hope it goes on for a lot longer because it is such a valuable piece of work. Thank you so much for the time today, Mark. I'm looking forward to our next one.
Thank you, Phil. It was really fun. It'd be great to reconnect again.
Before you go, I have a quick question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility with the wrong partnerships? It's exhausting to pretend everything's fine while secretly worrying that you've made the wrong call. You see others thriving with the right connections, and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities that could really elevate your business. Well, the good news is that ends today, because you can download my free partner calculator that instantly assesses if a partner is an ideal fit for your business. It'll give you the clarity and the confidence and the edge you've been looking for to secure high-value partnerships that not only finally unlock business growth, but also help you reclaim your time. The link is in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're here. I'm Coach Phil Hayes Sinclair. I'll see you in the next episode.